Welcome to 40A&M in 5, a download of 40A&M LLC, recorded at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday, December 16th. I'm Chris Bohm, and this is our weekly selection of tech sector-related global news and policy highlights from the past week. Coming up, U.S. regulators passed the long-awaited Volcker Rule. Reuters reports that confirmation of Janet Yellen could be voted on in the Senate this week, and Stanley Fischer is proposed to replace her as Fed Vice Chair. Nuala O'Connor will take the reins as the next head of the Center for Democracy and Technology in January. Two Facebook users meet online for a remarkable reunion and apology. Snapchat, all the rage with young users, but does its rise signal the importance of privacy online among youth? Statistics show that users are generally poor at creating good passwords, but also, many industries are still lagging in creating usually transparent policies, terms, and conditions. And finally, more revelations over the past week from the files leaked by Edward Snowden. And according to the New York Times, there may be signs that the leaks are changing policy. But first, each week we have tried to bring you at least one story on the financial services industry and international markets. And this week we had a big one. After nearly 2 years of advocacy by lobbyists, academics, and interested others, an intense period even by Washington standards, the long-awaited Volcker Rule was approved this past Tuesday by five U.S. agencies, the Federal Reserve, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, and the Securities and Exchange Commission. The rule, one of the most heavily debated outgrowths of the 2010 Dodd-Frank law, passed in the wake of the greatest economic crisis in the U.S. in generations, will largely prohibit banks from proprietary trading, which is essentially a ban on banks using their own funds for profit, if these funds are protected through federal deposit insurance or access to Federal Reserve loans. While industry lobbyists have long argued that proprietary trading did not contribute to the financial crisis, Wall Street saw the writing on the wall early, making large internal adjustments and closing proprietary trading shops shortly after passage of Dodd-Frank. In the 2 years since the Volcker Rule was proposed in draft, and championed by former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker, industry lobbied changes to the proposal have met with precious few successes, with the primary focus of their efforts most recently on how exemptions will be applied to permit banks to trade in service to a client, referred to in the industry as market making, and how the bank can engage in hedging against risks. In the final rule, any hedging must be shown to demonstrably reduce or otherwise significantly mitigate one or more specific identifiable risks. And this backstop must be in tandem with correlation analysis and ongoing calibration to support and manage the hedging, respectively. Also, much like a critical element of Sarbanes-Oxley and its panoply of corporate reporting requirements implemented in 2005, the Volcker Rule will require executives to certify that processes are in place and reasonably designed to achieve compliance. The rule will take effect in July of 2014, with the Federal Reserve voting on Tuesday to give banks extra time until July 2015 to come into compliance. And in related news, Reuters confirmed late last week that it is likely that the U.S. Senate will vote this coming week on President Obama's choice of Janet Yellen to be the next chief of the Federal Reserve. Last month, the Senate Banking Committee approved her nomination with a 14-8 vote, and it's widely expected that she will be confirmed by the Senate to replace Ben Bernanke, who steps down as Fed Chair effective January 31, 2014. It was also revealed late last week that Stanley Fischer is likely to be appointed Vice Chairman of the Federal Reserve to replace Janet Yellen in that role. In the midst of an unprecedented series of developments that commenced last spring, with rumors that Larry Summers was to be chosen to succeed Mr. Bernanke, and then Mr. Summers pulling himself out of contention, there has always been a strong undercurrent of discussion and praise for Stanley Fischer's work and the feeling that he would be an undeniable asset to the Fed. Not only has Mr. Fischer received highest marks for his handling of the Israeli economy, where he served as head of its central bank, and as longtime professor at MIT, where he, among other things, supervised Ben Bernanke's thesis, but he also has served as number two at the IMF during a time of financial crises from Asia to Mexico. Just as Janet Yellen has been widely recognized as the strongest credentialed candidate to lead the Fed in the modern era, Mr. Fischer's expertise internationally will no doubt be a tremendous asset to Ms. Yellen. In similar news, marking a passing of the baton, this past Wednesday, the Center for Democracy and Technology, or CDT, announced through its board of directors that Nuala O'Connor will be named incoming president and CEO to succeed Leslie Harris, who is stepping down after leading CDT for 9 years with an ever-present advocacy that has made Harris and CDT a critical fixture in U.S. and international technology policy. Most recently, Nuala O'Connor has served as Vice President for Compliance and Customer Trust to Amazon and as its Associate General Counsel for Privacy and Data Protection. She had previously been Chief Privacy Officer at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, and prior to that was instrumental as an attorney in the privacy group at GE, led at the time by Ivan Fong, in supporting what was then among the first successful binding corporate rules filings for data protection made in Europe. Ms. O'Connor was born in Belfast, Northern Ireland, and holds degrees from Princeton and Harvard Universities, as well as her law degree from Georgetown University. She will take over the helm at CDT effective January 21st of 2014. Another common theme among our weekly downloads has been at least one story in an episode highlighting an issue of human interest. We often hear about friends and acquaintances finding long-lost friends, loved ones, or sometimes relatives via social media. Rarely, if ever, do we come across a story, as we did this week, where a user of Facebook or Twitter seeks out someone to apologize for a wrong. Though such is a story reported on last week by the BBC, where Michael Goodman stepped forward on Facebook to apologize for mugging a man in New York City in 1976. Mr. Goodman had read a post on Facebook, according to the BBC, about a bagel shop closing down, a post that identified a Mr. Claude Soffel. Mr. Goodman recognized the name immediately and wrote a post to Mr. Soffel on Facebook, saying, according to the BBC, "You may not remember this, but a long time ago, trying to look like a tough guy, I walked up to you and mugged you for your bus pass as you stood outside the Museum of Natural History. I've never forgotten the incident or your name. Finally, I can say that I'm very sorry." Sometime later, Mr. Soffel replied to the Facebook post saying, "Clearly you're a bigger man today. I recognize your name now as well, so apology accepted. Let us now jointly put this in its proper place and behind us." Apparently, according to the BBC, undercover police had been working nearby that day back in 1976 and had apprehended Mr. Goodman immediately, who, being a minor, had been released to his father, who, in his words, was not too happy with me. Another common theme for us each week in 48M and 5 has been at least one story that highlights some kind of tech innovation, from use of drones to deliver packages to iPhone-enabled pulse ox monitors. Not all of the innovations we reported on should receive users' thumbs up or thumbs down, but nearly all have been thought-provoking. One innovation making news this week on the U.S.'s National Public Radio was Snapchat, the texting application that lets users send photos and short messages that disappear from a recipient's phone after just a few seconds. The application has become widely popular, particularly among teens, and because of its "this message will self-restruct" characteristic, a mode of privacy protection that almost makes one think of Mission Impossible, is also altering popular assumptions about how important young people tend to view their own privacy, according to NPR. Although the app, according to the NPR story, facilitates the sharing of more than 400 million photos every day, the shared material is not part of some permanent social media record. For years, according to NPR, the conventional wisdom was that privacy does not sell to kids, who simply don't care. Snapchat's popularity flies in the face of that once cherished belief. As Fred Kate, technology and privacy expert at Indiana University, commented to NPR, "Nothing would make me happier than to think that privacy has been gaining traction in the marketplace." However, despite its popularity, Snapchat is still not turning a profit. This despite the fact that Facebook has offered several billion dollars to buy it. In addition, as security experts point out, Snapchat does not leave users with a completely blank slate, as metadata regarding postings is retained, an area where only secure app tools like Wickr and Silent Circle offer self-destruct photo and messaging without traceable metadata. And as the NPR story points out, apps like Wickr and Silent Circle use a type of security labeled perfect forward security, where the encryption key for a message is only used once, and each new message generates a new key. Whereas some of us may be good at picking out new social media apps, BBC technology correspondent Mark Ward reports this past week that we are universally terrible at picking out good passwords. His article in the BBC Online cite that, particularly when it comes to four-digit PINs, most people drift toward a small subset of the 10,000 combinations possible, with in some cases nearly 80% using just 100 different number combinations. Also, frequently used passwords use birthdays, wedding days, the names of siblings, or children or pets, according to Mr. Ward, whereas a good password or phrase should involve a combination of characters that have little or no connection to the person picking it. As the article points out, Adobe, LinkedIn, and others have all been recently hit with the theft of login names and passwords. As we reported 2 weeks ago, Facebook has taken steps to help users whose passwords to their own site may have been compromised in the Adobe hack by virtue of there being the same passwords for both, a fairly common but incredibly insecure practice by users. Apart from users' self-help with regard to password security, Alan Brandt wrote for the International Association of Privacy Professionals' Practical Privacy column this past week that some in both industry and government are forging ahead to make privacy policies, terms and conditions much easier for consumers to read and understand. Mr. Brandt points out that the U.S. Federal Trade Commission's Bureau of Consumer Protection has frequently railed against the length and prolix nature of consumer-facing policies, many of which are rarely read by consumers, let alone understood. Frequently, he points out, policies are drafted by attorneys with an all-in approach, with a view toward eventual litigation rather than appropriately informing the user in any useful manner. A 2012 article by Britain's Daily Mail Online famously pointed out that, at the time, the user agreements of PayPal and Apple's iTunes were longer than Hamlet and Macbeth, respectively. Member of the European Parliament for Germany, Alexander Alvaro, noted in his article in October 2012 on lifecycle data protection management that many consumers are simply overwhelmed by the amount of information they're provided with, which at the time was an issue that the draft European data protection regulation was very weak in addressing. Some banks in the U.S., Mr. Brandt points out, have started to experiment with simpler documents, incorporating tables and abbreviated notices to make information easier to find and understand. And his own organization, GMAC, recently moved to converting its privacy policy into a series of one-minute videos. But clearly, while users need to do more self-help to ensure their own account privacy and security, industry can continue to improve how it facilitates transparency and consumer knowledge of policies and online terms. When 48MN5 began in late April of this year, we could not have imagined that one story, beginning with one individual, would so dominate the tech landscape as has been the case with Edward Snowden's revelations of U.S. National Security Agency surveillance measures engineered in the U.S. and abroad. It was noted in National Public Radio's All Things Considered on Thursday of this week that few stories of the past decade have had the staying power and repeated return to our news cycle consciousness as this one has. And indeed, as Guardian newspaper editor Alan Rutschberger told the UK's Home Affairs Select Committee in testimony this past week, only 1% of the Snowden leaked files have been published to date, in his estimation, using only 26 of the approximately 58,000 documents made available to the editor. The story, and how or if it changes surveillance policy, has been a critical one over the past 6 months, but we have taken pains to try to ensure that no single episode is weighted too heavily on it. The one exception to this rule was, of course, the week following the release of the NSA audit reports in August of this year. And when it comes to new revelations, this past week proved to be no exception. The Washington Post reported that the NSA is collecting mobile location and related mobile usage data in bulk, approximately 5 billion records per day worldwide, and using sophisticated algorithms to sift this data, infer relationships among mobile users, and assist with U.S. intelligence gathering operations. Part of this information gathering, as highlighted by the Post, relies on the fact that when a mobile device is turned on, it reveals its location as soon as it searches for a mobile network signal, information which is pulled into multiple databases maintained by telephone network operators and clearinghouse databases. In addition, many smartphones use Wi-Fi and GPS signals to fix their locations, as well as location data leaked along with IP addresses through location-enabled applications. In addition to mobile network data, it was also reported on this past week by the Washington Post that when companies use cookies to track consumer browsing and other patterns, this technique also opens the door for similar tracking by the NSA, surreptitiously piggybacking on the commercial tools. According to the documents reported on by the Post, the NSA and its British counterpart, the GCHQ, use this data not only to track website visits, but also to single out individual targets among a sea of communications data in order to send out software, for instance, that could hack a person's computer, essentially letting the agencies home in on somebody already under suspicion. And the New York Times, Guardian, and ProPublica each ran stories on U.S. and British spies infiltrating online games, such as World of Warcraft, in an effort to identify potential terrorist threats. At one point, according to the reports, so many national security experts were reportedly engaged in online gaming as a part of the investigation that a deconfliction group was created to ensure that the officials were not inadvertently spying on one another. All of these new discussions in the past week to 10 days perhaps best segue into a discussion of the New York Times article by David Sanger on Wednesday, highlighting that the Presidential Advisory Committee, charged by President Obama to examine NSA operations in the wake of the Snowden revelations, is likely to urge broad new restraints. These restraints would apply to the existing surveillance practices, while suggestions are that the broad phone data collection program in particular should continue. According to Mr. Sanger's report, officials examining the NSA programs have been surprised at how infrequently the agency has been challenged to weigh the intelligence benefits of its foreign collection operations against the damage that could be done if the programs were exposed. Thus, the advisory group is expected to also recommend that senior White House officials, including the president, should directly review any list of foreign leaders whose communications are routinely monitored by the NSA. In addition, the White House should conduct a regular review of data collection activities the way covert action by the CIA is reviewed annually. A further likely recommendation, according to the Times, is the creation of an organization of adversarial advocates who, like public defenders, would argue against NSA and other lawyers bringing surveillance matters before the FISA court. The five-person advisory group was expected to deliver its lengthy report to the president this weekend, and it is the first sign that the revelations by Mr. Snowden may lead to some changes in the programs he has exposed. As reported by the New York Times, while Mr. Snowden has been widely criticized in Washington for violating his oaths to protect secrets and for taking up asylum in Russia instead of facing prosecution, it now appears likely, at least in part, that his disclosures will lead to some of the results he has told interviewers he was seeking. And despite the illegality of Mr. Snowden's actions and the degree to which the national security community has condemned the impacts from what he has done, another surprise this past week may have been the fact that he, Edward Snowden, was runner-up for Time magazine's Person of the Year, a designation that Time points out is given to a person who has, for better or worse, impacted global life over the past 12 months. The winner of this designation this year was, of course, Pope Francis. And truth be told, many, including myself, thought that Time's selection would likely be this very 1-2. For some, the choice of Edward Snowden as runner-up may, in the best sense, represent where we have been this year, and Pope Francis, as Person of the Year, could perhaps represent where as a society we would like to go. But wherever you sit on the Time magazine cover story this week, its subjects, or in respect to the many topics we've tried to cover in 2013, it has been my pleasure to speak to you once a week. Your time and attention is a gift, and we wish for you the best of holiday seasons and New Year, wherever you are. All stories for this week's podcast were reported on by at least two online or print news sources, or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from the New York Times, National Public Radio, ProPublica, the BBC, the Washington Post, the International Association of Privacy Professionals, and the Daily Mail Online. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40a-m.com. Thank you, as always, for listening. 40 A&M and 5, we'll be back with you again on Monday, January 13th, 2014. Until then, make this week, and every week, one to remember. And bye for now.